That's right. My name is Dana Pretzer. You are listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Tonight, Mike Galbraith. We're going to continue on with our series of investigative reports on those parents who have had their children kidnapped and taken to Japan. Mike's the only foreign parent that we know of who's been able to recover a child. He's got one boy. There's still one boy there. This happened fairly recently, and his story has been in the news a lot lately. Mike's also an attorney, and he will join us here in just a couple of minutes. Jackie Hollander. Jackie sued the late James Brown for raping her, allegedly raping her, and she lost her case in the Supreme Court. Now, the ability to go and sue, should there be a time limit on something like that? Should there be time limits or statute of limitations for those who are victims of rape? Jackie will be with us tonight. Randy Tatt. Randy is a VP with Paramount Pictures. He's also an artist, and he has a new exhibit at the Zimmer Museum. He'll be around to talk to us. And then Jossie Mansour from Aruba. More craziness going on there. This time their government is trying to boycott Diario. That's Jossie's paper, and there's a lot more. Is there freedom of speech in Aruba? Is there freedom in Aruba? Jossie will be here to talk to us about that. That's tonight on the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Glad you could join us. Back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. A segment that we've been doing now for several weeks deals with parents who have had their children or child kidnapped and taken to Japan. It's a bizarre story that has affected parents from across the world. We've had Canadians and Americans and, well, you name it, on the program. But what we haven't had is a parent who's actually been able to recover a child. In this case, it's one child. Mike Galbraith is here. He's an attorney, and he's the only foreign parent that we know of at this time that's been able to recover a child that has been taken to Japan. Mike, welcome to the Dana Pretzer Show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, again, you know, and I've said this time after time, interview after interview that I've done here regarding this story, and it's just so bizarre that one foreign nation is able to be complicit in kidnapping cases like this. And again, we've had Canadians, Americans, you name it, on here. Tell us about your story and the fascinating part about getting one child back. And that must be tough, too, because you know your other boy is still there.
Absolutely. You know, in brief, my story begins in 1996 when my wife and I, ex-wife and I, divorced. And about a year later, she remarried a Caucasian gentleman who was in a previous marriage. And it wasn't too long after that that I began hearing things from my boys about some of the things that this gentleman was doing to him as far as possible physical abuse and whatnot.
Right.
And it developed from there in that in the summer of 1999, I received a call from the Utah State Department of Child and Family Services indicating that they were investigating this individual for possible child abuse, not only involving my two sons, but his natural children from his first marriage. And being a nosy father that I am, I decided to look into it a bit and got nowhere with my ex-wife, was told to stay out of it.
Right.
And it wasn't maybe a month or so after that that Department of Child and Family Services in Utah substantiated the abuse allegation against this individual, at which point I asked the court for full custody.
Absolutely. And I don't think you're a nosy father. You're a concerned father and
absolutely
a caring father who any father on earth that has a lick of sense would have done the same thing.
Yeah, I would hope so as well. That's where it really got interesting. As soon as I petitioned the court for full custody and modification of the custody arrangement, it became pretty apparent that my ex-wife and her husband were going to try and do everything to not only stop it, but they also put plans in place to move to Japan for financial benefit, as they put it. And just to give you a little more background, my ex-wife was born and raised in Japan. She is a naturalized U.S. citizen, however.
Right.
Her current spouse is a full U.S. citizen, born and raised here, you know, never spent any significant amount of time overseas at all. But in any event, had to go to the extraordinary steps of asking the court to put a temporary restraining order in place because it became apparent that they were going to try and bolt. And lo and behold, November 2001, in violation of the restraining order and against court orders, she took the children and fled to Japan.
Knowing very well that the Japanese government would not do anything to cooperate with other governments as far as getting your children back?
Exactly. We had raised that issue with the court several times. And in my case, you know, the law in Utah is pretty clear on a modification, particularly where there are allegations of abuse. The court has to appoint a guardian ad litem,
right,
specially trained attorney for the kids, as well as a evaluator. And so we went through, you know, the guardian ad litem and the custody evaluation, and the result of that was they recommended that the kids should be with me. And, of course, my ex-wife was still trying to convince the court to be allowed to move to Japan with the boys. And when it became apparent that that just wasn't going to happen, she just up and absconded.
Now, our parents in these cases, yours and all the others that we've covered here and many others that we still haven't, are they aware of the fact that Japan is a haven for parents who take their children? Are they getting advice to go there? Or that's a question I've always wanted to ask, and I'll ask you that. Why do they head that way? I know your wife is Japanese, but she's still a U.S. citizen, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think excellent question. I think Japan is getting the name or reputation as a haven for parental abductors. I mean, you hear stories in the past, the news of, you know, Middle Eastern countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and whatnot. But according to the, you know, statistics that the United States State Department has shared with myself and fathers, left behind parents in similar situations, of what we would call absolutely friendly countries to the U.S., Japan is the number two offender, if you will, in not only the number of cases, but the absolute zero success rate in gaining any type of access to children that are abducted to Japan.
Now, the State Department, you say, has these statistics, and everyone has talked to the State Department, but it's the question that I ask, and I'll keep asking every time I cover this topic on my program here. What has the government not done or done for you that they could do more of? Like, this is just so bizarre.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Japan. I've lived there for over 10 years. I'm completely fluent in all aspects of the language. I believe I'm culturally in tune with the country. And what could the U.S. government do better? Frankly, I think the model that the Japanese government is using for their children abducted to North Korea is a model that I would like to see our Congress, our elected officials, our diplomatic corps to engage at the same level that the Japanese government has, and bringing these left-behind parents and family members to the U.S. to meet with congressmen, to let their story be known in the public, and trying to rally support of the international community to, you know, these children. Abduction is abduction. It's a sad story that has to go through it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's what gets to be even more interesting with your story is your two boys were taken from you. Praise the Lord, you were able to get one boy back, but that's got to be tough, too. Let's get into the story of how you were able to get your one son back.
Okay. He's the second of my boys. His name is Christopher. He's 16 now. And just out of the blue one day, I'd had, all forms that I had with the boys were essentially cut off for several years. I'd made trips over to Japan and tried to see him and was unsuccessful at most efforts. Email, telephone, any of that contact was just non-existent.
Right.
Chris had gotten a part-time job in Japan, had saved enough money to get a cell phone. And with that cell phone came the ability to text message.
Ah.
And out of the blue, I was just sitting at my computer working one night, and I get this text message saying, "Hi, this is Chris."
Wow.
And I was like, you just get these chills because it's like, oh my gosh.
Well, it's either true or somebody's pulling your leg.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, I'm going to remain calm. And I emailed him back. I said, "Hey, Chris, this is Dad. How you doing?" From there, he continued to text message me and opened up a little bit once we were sure that we were actually talking to each other.
Exactly, yeah.
And he said, "I want to get out of Japan. Can you help me?"
Mm-hmm.
And I had done everything I could in lining up all of the assistance of the U.S. government. Here's one place where I have to give, in my case, the government officials some props, in that the State Department did everything they legally could and should in helping me get Christopher out of Japan, as well as the FBI, the Diplomatic Security Service, which is the law enforcement branch of the State Department, as well as, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents and officers. This was back in July of last year, where I got this first string of text messages. We hatched a plan, and long story short, the first attempt was unsuccessful.
Right.
Chris got a little excited and began telling people that he was going to America.
There you go. Okay.
Japan being a very tight-knit society, and the fact that he was in an international school that was a small community, it got back to his mom pretty quickly, and she put a stop to it.
Okay.
She took his phone away for about a month, confiscated his wallet, which had, his only picture ID in it, which he was going to need to pick up a passport that had been arranged for him, as well as started collecting his money from his part-time job, so he had no money.
Right.
About a month later, she gave him his phone back, saying, "I trust you, and I know you won't do this again."
Mm-hmm.
And he tells me the first thing he did was he text messaged me again and said, "We got to do it again. I know what I did wrong, and I'm not going to tell a soul this time." Which you kind of feel bad because you're telling your son that he's got to, you know, he's got to keep this quiet or it won't work, and you know he's got to be torn between, you know, telling his older brother who hasn't fully expressed a desire to leave Japan at this point, and obviously keeping it from his mother, that, you know, there's a bond there.
Oh, absolutely.
Regardless of what has gone on, there's still a bond there.
How old was Chris at the time?
He was 15.
Wow, and you know, to go through something like that, the thought process of a 15-year-old to, you know, come up with a plan, so to speak, I'm sure he'd been thinking about it for a long time. You got to give kudos to that boy.
Oh, absolutely. And the marvels of modern technology and his just calm demeanor in text messaging me everywhere along his path from just outside of Nagoya to Osaka, where he had to go to pick up his passport, to get out to the airport, to get through, you know, there was a ticket waiting for him, to get through security.
Jeez.
Fun part was getting through immigration.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know, with an emergency passport issuance, it's, you know, they don't go through all the niceties that you get when you get a normally issued passport. It's just
right.
a instant photo that is affixed with an embosser, and of course then there were no entry stamps or stickers in there, and so the Japanese immigration officials wanted to know when he'd come to Japan, why he was leaving, and they actually pulled him out for a secondary screening for about an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh boy. Must have been tense the whole time.
Well, he was pretty terrified at that point. I stayed up all night at my computer while he was going through this process, and he checked in at every checkpoint that we had given him. And at about that hour and 20-minute point where, you know, he was actually, he's a very fast text messenger, as a lot of kids are. He was able to shoot me off a note as they pulled him out for the secondary screening. And so I waited as long as I thought as I possibly could, and then I dialed his cell phone number.
Right.
And he actually, as he demonstrated to me later, he held the phone up while he's in this mini interrogation room to the Japanese immigration officials in English, "Would you like to speak to my father?" And they took his cell phone and chatted with me for about 15, 20 minutes. They just said, "We need to get some answers to questions and fill in our paperwork because we have no record of him entering the country, and you know this replacement passport doesn't have any stamps or entry information, so we just need to make sure our paperwork's right."
Right. How about any retribution from your ex-wife or her current spouse towards your son that is still there? That's what I'd be concerned about.
It's been an excellent question, Dana. It has been what I would think is just unbearable and actually just frankly appalling. His mother has not called, written, sent birthday gifts, Christmas gifts, or anything. The last time that Chris heard from his mom was New Year's. He sent a brief email saying, "Happy New Year."
Right.
Other than that, they refused to talk to him or communicate with him. In fact, I encouraged Chris to call and to send emails to try and keep those communication lines open, and they simply do not respond.
One of the things that baffles me, and in a couple of the other cases too, your ex-wife is actually a U.S. citizen, yet she was able to obtain some sort of immigrant status, I assume, in Japan in order to abduct these children there. Is there no immigration policy or anything from the Japanese perspective where a U.S. citizen brings their children to Japan? There has to be some sort of a status, would there not?
Yeah, there is, and it's really an interesting irony, if you will, in that Japan has got, you know, really one of the strictest immigration policies of you know, G7, G8 countries. as far as how it tracks foreign nationals that enter the country and the requirements that they have to go through to stay or to obtain work status or any type of resident alien status. In my ex-wife's case, she was born and raised in Japan. She was a Japanese citizen who naturalized to U.S. citizenship.
Okay.
And so with her mother, she was an only child, and her mother remained in Japan, and so mom was actually able to be a sponsor for the entire group.
All right. As we continue on, and our time is winding down here a little bit, I want to get into the whole perspective now of your other son that's there. How old is your son that's still in Japan?
He's 17.
Okay. Now, from the Japanese government perspective, when does your son become an adult where he can make his own choices, leave the country as he sees fit?
That would be at 20.
Oh, at 20.
In Japan, the way you become an adult at 20.
Okay. Now, do you have any sort of legal representation in Japan? Are you continuing on with a legal fight, if that's even possible, with this?
I do have an attorney that represents my interests there. I was lucky enough to very early on, when we got all of the orders out of the Utah court, I was able to have everything translated into Japanese. It's ironic, under the Hague Convention on services process and whatnot, Japan requires that everything be translated into Japanese and be, you know, just perfect. There can't be a punctuation mark out of place. There can't be any improper grammar or anything.
Right.
Had to go through professional services to have all that done, and my U.S. court orders were actually accepted by the family courts in Japan and entered over there. But enforcement is the issue.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And
it has no mechanism, even for two Japanese nationals that have divorced and are in a situation like this, or whether it comes to visitation, child support, or any of those related items. They have no enforcement mechanism under the law in Japan. You're basically left at your own devices.
I'm seeing another story here about you suing the LDS Church for ordaining your son, who was abducted to Japan against his wishes. This story just seems to have so many different twists and plots.
it's got the makings of a Lifetime movie, possibly. yes, when the boys were abducted to Japan, I knew that the Allreds, my ex-wife remarried to an Allred, Mr. Allred, I knew that they would be attending a local LDS or Mormon congregation in Japan. So I made contact and connections with the local church leaders in Japan, as well as Salt Lake City, advised them of the custody status, advised them that the Allreds were wanted on federal kidnapping charges, and I asked the LDS Church not to cooperate with them in any manner, as well as not to take any religious action or ordination action with my children without
right.
my consent and knowledge.
Right.
And what happened is not once but twice they did, and the second time they tried to hide it from me, and even instructed local church members in Japan to no longer communicate with me to provide information about my boys and their well-being or how they were doing, or to send me pictures of them and whatnot. And worked with the church for about 5 years to simply get an apology, and they refused. And I was like, you know, this is an important enough issue that I think we should see what the courts think.
You're darn right.
I believe it is a serious parental rights issue, and particularly knowing, you know, the background of the situation and going to the lengths that they did to cover up the second ordination and asking people not to provide any information, I thought was just absolutely contrary to what any Christian organization would or should do.
Yeah. Just in the last couple of minutes here, I'd like to talk a little bit about, and maybe it's difficult for you to speak for your son that's with you now, but the difficulties of his brother still being in Japan, him coming to America, your family still being split. I'm sure you're happy as anything to have one son home, but the fight continues for your second son. Let's talk about that aspect of it.
Excellent question. This may sound somewhat odd, but I'm only 50% satisfied.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the reason being is that, you know, Mr. Allred's and Chris, I'm sure, would vouch and speak loudly of this if given the opportunity. Mr. Allred's abusive tendencies have not changed in the entire time that they've been in Japan. Chris is a big kid. You know, he's 6'2" and 205 pounds now.
That's a big kid.
Yeah, and his brother is about the same size, but Chris is, he's born 4 months early, so he's always been a fighter. He was a severe premature baby. He's always been a fighter in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to stand for something that I just believe is wrong, and so when Mr. Allred would try and mistreat him, Chris would stand up and not lash out first, but defend himself. And he'd also step in between Mr. Allred and his brother Michael. Michael was a bit more timid for whatever reasons and was afraid of Mr. Allred. And Chris has spoken frequently of the fact that he does fear for Michael in that he's no longer there to be a buffer.
Right.
And those are his exact words. I'm no longer a buffer for Mike, and we've got serious concerns about his safety.
Well, you know, these stories, you know, we've talked now for 25 minutes. We could do a whole hour on this program, and we'll have you back on again sometime soon. More information on your story can be found at...
There's a couple places, crnjapan.com, also crcjapan.com. A simple Google search of my name or Christopher's name or my ex-wife's name will bring up a multitude of stories and documents and whatnot, as well as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children maintains missing children's posters on their website. So if you search under my children's name and under the state of Utah, missing within the last 6 years, you'll see a missing child poster for my son Michael and for the two abductors.
All right. Well, we'll continue covering this story and others on the show as long as we can. And hopefully some politicians will get off their hands and start to do what's right, because you're only 50% satisfied, but you are 100% wronged in this situation.
Absolutely.
And it's time that it changes. Thanks for coming on the show, sir.
Dana, can I share one more thing?
Absolutely.
There's the Prime Minister of Japan will be visiting Washington, D.C., beginning April 26th through the 27th, possibly the 28th, and CRC Japan will be holding a candlelight vigil on the 26th and 27th, both in front of the White House as Prime Minister Abe visits President Bush, as well as in front of the Japanese Embassy in Washington. And anybody that might have friends, family, or those that are sympathetic to what left-behind parents go through of all international abductions, we'd encourage them to come out and join us and be peaceful, but be united and strong in our message.
Absolutely. Again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Good night.
Yeah, good night.
Tell me where.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. This segment is a follow-up segment to a show that we did a ways back, and a follow-up to a commentary that I did here the other day. I'll share an AP story. It's very short. It says the Supreme Court on Monday declined to revive a sexual harassment lawsuit filed by a woman who claims that the late soul singer James Brown raped her nearly 20 years ago. The justices did not comment on their order. Jackie Hollander said in her lawsuit that Brown raped her at gunpoint in 1988 while she was his publicist. On the phone here with me now is Jackie Hollander. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to have you back on the show.
Nice to be back.
Now, the court case was obviously another slam. You've gone through enough as it is. I'm not sure if you've heard my daily commentary that I did a couple of days back talking about rape victims and time limits and things like that. And that's why we're here tonight. When you were on the show last time, you had a gag order that you had to follow. That's not so right now.
There are some things I have to, I think, be careful with, but
right.
I think I'm pretty okay to talk.
Okay, let's talk about, first of all, the lawsuit, the ruling from the Supreme Court, and then we're going to get into the whole gist of this, because there's some political and legal issues for other victims that need to be taken care of now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into, let's go back to 1988 and your relationship, if you could say that, with James Brown.
Well, I don't want to call it a relationship. I would say that it was more of a working relationship.
Right.
In which I produced him on a song. And I think it's important. I think a lot of people wonder why I waited so many years to take this man in court. They have to understand that I was violently raped by this man and went through years of intimidation and harassment from him and his entourage. So I basically lived in fear, and I spent a lot of time in therapy, too. So I wanted to get that on the record.
Absolutely. Rape victims live in fear. They are violated right from the beginning, and this is something that just doesn't disappear like a bad cold. You live with it for the rest of your life. My whole problem with everything, right from the offense itself to what the Supreme Court ruled, is that they're making you be a victim all over again because of some sort of silly time limits. Let's talk about that.
You know, and I think it's important. I happen to hear Glenn Beck tonight, oddly enough, talking about how the laws don't need to exist. There needs to be no statute of limitations for victims.
I agree.
And I took this case to the Supreme Court, not for Jackie Hollander. I took it for the thousands and thousands of rape victims that are out there across the country. And I think it's a sad day when the Supreme Court, and you know, they can't make the laws. It's up to our legislatures. It's up to our senators to make the laws. The Supreme Court can only deal with the laws that are existing now. But I had to make that road. I had to make that pave road up to the United States Supreme Court for them. And in my state of Illinois now, and I'm so blessed, we are making a change. The Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, they have been like a light and a beacon for me. And there is a bill right now in front of the House, HB 1462, which will be the equitable estoppel bill, which I argued in the United States Supreme Court. And that will change the law, and hopefully another woman will never have to walk in my shoes again.
Now, this law, let's talk about that. You're looking to remove the statute of limitations altogether?
Yes. It would remove the statute, and it would stop the predators from harassing, intimidating, and basically holding their victim in silence and fear, which is, you know, so many people said to me, oh, well, I've never heard of anything like this. Well, let me assure you that every rape victim is held in silence and fear and intimidated. For the world to think that doesn't happen, That's ludicrous.
Rape victims are held to that, and a big part of that is because they feel that they'll be put on trial, that the blame will be put onto them. Let's talk about the celebrity aspect of this and the whole persona of this being held over your head and why you had to wait so long. Because yes, you were in fear of your safety and your life, but how do you convince someone that the public holds in high esteem, so to speak, not me personally, but the other public, how do you convince people that this person did something like this without making yourself look bad?
You know, Dana, I woke up Christmas morning to pandemonium. I, unlike the rest of the world, I got a call early, mid-morning, before, you know, it broke, so much so in the news.
Right.
And I was just, I was taken back by the reaction of the world. I had to watch Reverend Al Sharpton on national television continuously portraying Mr. Brown as an icon. And I thought, you know, that we all know that Reverend Al Sharpton was involved in the Tawana Brawley rape case back in 1988. But what was so hypocritical in the whole situation was that James Brown, who Reverend Sharpton called like a father to him, was brutally beating his wife at the same time and shooting and threatening to kill her. So here I am Christmas morning watching Mr. Sharpton out there calling Mr. Brown an icon, and the world is mourning him. And this went on CNN for, you know, hours at a time for days. They're painting him as an icon. And I'm thinking, Mr. Brown, I am not the only victim. We have other victims of Mr. Brown here. We have, and it's been in the media. It's not like it was a hidden secret. And this was a 7-felony. This man had committed 7 felonies, and he got a full pardon. Now, you or I, if we had done that, would still be in Sing Sing, clinging our cups, trying to get his attention.
Right. Absolutely. And I wanted to get to the next question, is the celebrity aspect of this. Even the funeral, Al Sharpton, and you're right, the nonstop coverage on CNN became, well, it was ludicrous after a while that this man was being put up on such a high pedestal. Yet before that, the only time you ever heard about James Brown is when he was in trouble with the law. Let's talk about the news media, the entertainment aspect of it. Is CNN wrong for doing something like this, or do they cover something like that because the public is generally interested?
Well, I think CNN was totally wrong in this. I mean, CNN did not look at the fact that there was a case in the United States Supreme Court with a rape victim. CNN was well aware of this man's brutal past. They were well aware of the fact that he had brutally beat his wife, threatened to kill her. That was his deceased wife, is now, of course, we all know the Tommy Ray Haney story of whether she is or is not his wife, where he threatened to kill her, too. And I think CNN stepped way out when they covered his funeral and we had a president dead.
Right.
I mean, we had Gerald Ford.
Absolutely.
A wonderful man who had passed away, and here was James Brown being hailed an icon and everything else, and it was continuous CNN coverage.
If you're just tuning in, Jackie Hollander is here. We're talking about her lawsuit that the Supreme Court on Monday declined to revive against the late James Brown for raping her nearly 20 years ago. We talked, Jackie, about the new bill that will be taken care of here in the next little while. What more can we do if we can't help victims of crime? If we can't hold those that commit crime accountable through punishment, then we're failing as a society. You look at O.J. Simpson. You look at James Brown. You look at Robert Blake. That Looney Tune Phil Spector is before the courts right now. Hopefully he'll be convicted. But celebrity seems to have a way of buying themselves out of trouble. what can we do differently as a public to stop this and hold them as accountable as anyone else?
Well, our media has to stop portraying them as gods and as icons. Our media has to start by placing the truth out there and not the spin. And the media, they're not fools. They know what is spin and they know what is not spin.
Right.
And James Brown was the master of spin. Reverend Al Sharpton is the master of spin. And when they come on these shows, the media needs to say, okay, you're saying this. Let's get some victims on here. Let's hear what they have to say.
Well, changing law is a great start. I look at the Smith family with the cruise ships that are covering up the death of the Smith individual on his honeymoon. The big money against the mom and pop family that are just trying to get some answers. You went to court because you lived under fear and intimidation for all those years because this rich celebrity excuse the term, but he's still holding a gun to your head because you weren't able to go and proceed with what you wanted and what you should have been able to do.
But you know what, Dana? I, in many ways, I've won. I mean, I did what no one thought could be done. I took this man all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
That's true.
I look at this like one of my investigators is a Navy SEAL. And helped put me back together. And he basically taught me about, you know, the man in the ring. And I stood in the ring with my boxing gloves on, and of course, Christmas morning, I was left there all alone because my match was over.
Right.
It didn't matter how the match went down. I was the last man standing in the ring against all of the odds. And now I use what I learned through these 19 years, and I walked into the state capitol in Illinois, and I spoke to the state representatives, and I'm seeing a difference now. I'm watching a law change, and, you know, this to me is the greatest win in the world. If I can watch life change for other victims because of what I went through, the 19 years I have suffered, it's the most, you know, it was the greatest gift God could give me. So basically, I've won.
Well, that's admirable for you to think this way. Helping victims is about as admirable as you can get. But I want to go back to you a little bit. The recovery process, if I can use the term recovery, you never recover from something like this, I don't think. I think you're just able to handle it or cope with it. It may be a better term. Let's talk about you a little bit. 19 years of living with this, the hell that you went through before that, and now this, and your focus is now, I can see, with switching the law and helping others that have gone through this tragedy like you have. But what about you, Jackie? You've got a long life to live yet. I'm sure there are nights when you close your eyes and you lay down to sleep that your mind is racing a million miles an hour. Let's talk about how you're coping.
There are nights where I wake up. I wake up out of my sleep, and I see Mr. Brown's face, not the way the world saw him, but with the white foam coming out of his mouth and the insanity in his eyes. I see that. And, of course, every time I hear a song on the radio that is his, I have to walk out of the room.
Right.
And so many commercials played his music, and it really affected me. But and there are weekdays, and there's good days, and I will have that till the day that I take my last breath. And that is one of the biggest injuries that a rapist can do to his victim, is that the victim, while the rapist goes free, the victim serves the sentence in prison. And I can truthfully say that I've served James Brown's sentence. I have paid the ultimate price for James Brown to be called an icon.
Psychological torture should never be permitted. Again, let's get back to rape victims today. You're a counselor, you're called in to speak to a young girl, 19, 20, 17, doesn't matter the age. And you can see the terror in her eyes. You can see the hurt. You can see the bruises if necessary, whatever. What do you tell her? How do you prepare someone who has gone through what you've gone through for what's going to happen and continue to happen for a very long time?
You can't prepare them, and for the court systems to believe that a rape victim can be ready in 2 years to go into court, it's unimaginable. Some rape victims never recover enough to be able to face their attackers. Some rape victims, it takes 5 to 10 years. And this is what our laws need to look at, is the fact that they need psychological wellness before they can ever face an attacker. And so what? Let the rapist go, you know. Let him hang out there. But when you bring him into court, then you've got him. But you're not going to have him if you've got a weak victim. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, I understand what you're saying.
You've got to get that victim well.
And that should be a thought that the prosecutor, the DA, whoever, the system, you need to prepare your victim in order to build your case against the person who's committed the crime. Because,
exactly, yeah. And they give a 2-year statute for a victim to file a lawsuit.
Crazy.
And I think this is very important for most people to understand. Most victims, when they get raped, are not looking up and going, oh, gee, I got to go file a civil suit against my rapist.
Right.
They're not thinking about that. They're not thinking about the fact that this rapist may have given him AIDS or may have given him some other disease. They're not thinking about those things. Right at that moment, they are thinking about a safe, warm place, survival, and not a bunch of people making them feel like a victim again. And I think there's just a lot. There needs to be a new structure for victims, you know, in this country. And our country needs to take a look at protecting the victims and not the predators. Because we right now protect our predators. We do not protect our victims.
We talk about consequences, mandatory minimum sentences for child sexual predators, rapists. We should have mandatory minimum sentences for them also. So if there is a consequence, maybe there will be a second thought as far as doing the crime. You may not be able to prevent the first one, but the second one. But then when it comes right down to it, Jackie, I don't know if a rapist can be rehabilitated. It's a sickness. They're an animal, and they can't be taken care of.
They cannot be rehabilitated. And I think when someone rapes somebody one time, that's it. Get them off the street. If you have to lock them up, lock them up. I don't care if it's James Brown. I don't care who it is. You know, this man should have never been allowed to beat women. He should have never been allowed to continue assaulting women. He should have been off the street. I don't care if he's saying, I feel good living in America. I don't care.
Right.
This man should have been in prison where he belonged. And for Reverend Al Sharpton to get on national television for days on end for a week and hail this man an icon, it, you know, please.
Let's talk, Jackie, a little bit about the, I call them the talking heads, the celebrity lawyers that you see on the cable news shows that
right.
come on and voice their opinion and spin, if you may, about situations like this. I'm sure you had a lot to do with a lot of celebrity lawyers, so to speak. Is there a conscience with a celebrity lawyer, or is it strictly follow the money trail?
I think it's follow the money trail. Definitely. you know, I listened to Deborah Opry. This was, she oddly enough represented Larry Birkhead.
Right.
But she did represent James Brown in my case. And this was a lawyer. Now, they're supposed to be officers of the court. They're supposed to be truthful. This lady went and put it all in the news that I had been found frivolous in a case in 2002 in California with James Brown. There never was a case in California. I was never found frivolous by a judge. I was never in front of a judge to be found frivolous. It was a bold-faced lie that Deborah Opry came up with, threw it out there in the public, and it stuck. And it was a major spin control to make me look bad. And she got away with it.
And that kind of gets me to my next question, Jackie, about the lawyers that do appear on the cable news shows that are talking about their cases. Cases like this that are being shown on court TV, is there a fault with the system when they publicize the case so much that there has to be an opinion for those who could be potential jurors, judges, or whatever?
You know, sometimes, unfortunately, as in my case, celebrity rides it. We did not get the major chance to discuss my case out in the public. Whereas, of course, James Brown's side was out there with their spin.
Right.
So, but you look at the Anna Nicole Smith right now case going on. I mean, this is a young woman that is dead. She is dead. And if you look at what tragically transpired prior to her death, Deborah Opry getting out there, constantly berating this woman. She had just lost her son, for God's sakes. And this lawyer could have, Miss Opry could have stayed back. She could have stayed back and said, you know, clearly she lost her child. Let's give her a chance to heal. Why play this in the media? This was a very private thing. But they play it in the media, and here you have a tragic death of a young lady.
And the media loves it because it brings them ratings.
I mean, it's the shark circling the blood.
That's
that's basically what this boils down to. And of course, I had some good guidance from Larry Garrison, so I really had a nice man talking to me, guiding me through some pit holes there. I was very fortunate.
You say that the legislatures are looking at the law. What's next for you, Jackie?
What's next for Jackie is, of course, there's always the book deals and the movie deals sitting.
Right.
And I do still own some of the masters that he sang on. And wouldn't it be a hoot if they went up for auction and some of that money went down and helped our Illinois Coalition Against Sexual, you know, Assault, and some of the Cumbie Center down there in Aiken, South Carolina, where some of Mr. Brown's victims walked through that door. It would be a hoot to see some of them come out, because Mr. Brown never really did anything good for them, so this would be a good way of helping.
And a good thing to publicize the heck out of that, too.
I mean, you know, and I'd really, you know, I'm going to set the record straight one day. I'm going to release the truth, and it's going to come out one way or another. I believe that lying dogs never lay still long, so I think the truth will come out. And I'm hopefully going to go into our Capitol and watch the laws change and see a wonderful state like Illinois take care of their victims, wrap their arms around them and say, hey, we love you. We're going to take care of you, and you predators, you can no longer harass and intimidate the victims. Now you can sit in jail.
What can we in the media do differently, Jackie?
I think you've made a major step. You've brought me on. You talk about victims' rights. And I think that your listeners have made a major step by listening. But please, go to your legislators, go to your senators, and tell them that it is so important that this equitable estoppel bill get passed, and that maybe it'll carry on throughout the states. You know, it only takes one torch lit and a couple of voices singing before a whole choir is heard. And I think that is so important.
And if we can't protect our victims, I don't know who we can protect. Jackie Hollander, thanks for coming on.
Dana, thank you, and good talking to you again.
We'll stay in touch.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Donna, the prima donna.
she would love me so. But in time I realized she had a pair of roving eyes. I remember the nights we dated, always acting sophisticated, talking about high society. Then she tried to make a fool out of me. They call her.
And you're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Our website is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live, download podcasts, listen to my daily commentary, leave comments, whatever. We're also on Trust Cable Channel 46 in Alabama, Satellite W3957, in DigiCypher 2 Audio, and wherever else you can pick us up. We'll be back here in a minute or two with one of the vice presidents of Paramount Pictures, and a pretty good artist himself. Randy Tatt will be here, and I want you to check out his webpage, www.tattonthewall.com. We're going to talk about a recent art exhibit at the Zimmer Museum that Randy is involved in, and talk about media somewhat, too. That's here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back with Randy Tatt.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us pledge allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be faithful.
Oh,
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. You know, anything that we hear about the media lately either has to do with a celebrity that's just passed away, nonstop coverage on who's the father of who's ever baby, and people coming out of the woodwork about this or that, negatives as far as celebrities getting in trouble with the law. The entertainment industry itself, I believe, has received a black eye in the last little while. It seems like we see more weird stuff than we do normal stuff. I fixed that. I've got Randy Tatt with me tonight. He's a executive VP of production with Paramount Pictures, a multi-talented and gifted artist. He's a painter, interior designer, illustrator, cartoonist, and television executive VP. How can you beat that? And he has a new exhibit at Zimmer, at the Zimmer Museum. Randy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, it's interesting to see a story in the media about someone in the media and not having it negative. Now, I don't know if you've got several different wives and four or five different kids and all that sort of stuff, or if you've robbed any banks. I don't think so. You seem like a pretty normal guy to me, and you're a hell of an artist. Let's talk about this exhibit at the Zimmer Museum.
Oh, you're so kind. The Zimmer Museum is this amazing experience. And for the last 3 years, they've had these exhibits. Actually, the first exhibit was called The Art of Communication, where they gave 50 artists and humanitarians a phone they had to create a piece of artwork for. Here they did an exhibit called The Art of Time, where each artist was given a clock, and they had to create an assemblage based on, you know, a clock from, you know, either 1920 or a retro 1950s clock,
right,
or, you know, something that had kind of a space age sort of modern look. This year, the exhibit is called The Art of Harmony, and they've given artists and humanitarians each an instrument, and they've had to create a piece of artwork, you know, out of the instrument. And I was given a flute,
uh-huh,
and, you know, initially, you know, my thought, you know, what am I doing? What am I going to do with a flute? I thought of making a lamp. That's been done before. I thought of incorporating a flute into a painting. But then it dawned on me, I wanted to really take this and figure out a way to maintain the integrity of the flute, but create something that was magical and, you know, hopefully transform it into, you know, an amazing, dramatic experience. And so I created this candelabra, which basically transforms the actual flute into the stunning silver Baroque candelabra that could have once adorned the halls of, you know, majestic 15th century castle in Italy. I embellished this candelabra with all sorts of great jeweled accessories, lavender quartz, iridescent jewels, and tried to figure out a way to maintain the integrity of the flute as the center core, which is, you know, attached without welding or soldering, miniature Italian porcelain musicians, you know, that decorate the sides of it. So at the end of the day, you light this magical candelabra, and it's sitting on your baby grand at a dinner party. But when you're done, you can take it apart and play the flute.
Well, that's great. That's great. Is this an escape for you? Is this something that you're a busy guy, obviously, to sit down and put the thought process into something like this as you have? Must be a great relaxation for you, a way to concentrate on something that you know will become something.
Well, I strongly believe that in all of us, you know, we all have to, you know, make a living to support our lifestyle, our families. You know, we all have, you know, financial commitments and obligations. But at the core of who we are, we also have dreams and have creative ideas that we need to figure out a way to express and really, you know, find an opportunity to be able to share those qualities with everyone. And personally,
You know, at the end of the day, you know, I try to commit to at least 2 or 3 hours, whether it's 1 o'clock in the morning or, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning, and really try to, you know, paint or, you know, design. On the weekends, my therapy is, you know, renovating a room. You know, I do find a lot of great excitement and reward in doing that. So in my own way, I try to feed my soul and express as much as I can to the people around me.
And that's just it, an artist's expression. How did you get into being an artist? Is this something that you've always done since a child?
Yeah, my entire life I've always been captivated by style and design and color and balance. And as a kid, it sounds crazy, but I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and, you know, this great little house in a nice community. I shared a room with my brother, and my creative outlet was every couple months I would completely redo my side of the room. I know it sounds kind of corny, but I would take that over the top. I would, you know, create, you know, a spaceship 1 month, or I would, you know, I remember, you know, in the 70s, I'm dating myself, but I would create a 70s disco with a light and all sorts of great neon and, you know, painted walls with, you know, really interesting, you know, furry sort of shaggy rugs. You know, I've always been kind of the guy that, you know, whether it was, you know, whether I was in, you know, college, at my fraternity, I always tried to create that. It really showed my identity, and that gave me a lot of joy.
Is there that creative aspect or that creative part of all of us? And I talk about the trend on the reality television that we have now with the makeover type shows, the rebuilding shows, and the decorating shows, and they're hugely popular. And that's something that we didn't see even 5, 10 years ago.
Well, everyone loves to see something, you know, start to finish. Everyone loves to see, you know, whether you're watching a game show and you see a contestant, you want to wait till the end to see if that contestant, you know, made a lot of money. Or a design show, they start off with, you know, a bedroom that, you know, is in shambles, and they start, you know, renovating it and adding color and style. You want to see it to the end, you know, and that's the beauty of it.
Is it a public's fascination with something like that, or is it just you want to see the final product?
Well, I think, you know, you want to see the final product, but in this day and age, everyone is so conscious of their surroundings. You know, we work so hard, and there's so many distractions in our world, and to be able to come home, whether it's a one-bedroom studio, whether it's a, you know, palatial, beautiful, you know, home, whether it's a tent, for that matter. We all want to feel really comfortable and, you know, proud of where we live. And that quality time that we spend, you know, in our space, that helps us get through our lives or deal with it a lot easier.
One article I read here, Randy, says your house used to belong to John Wayne. And when someone walks into your house, it's like entering a magical world. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I love all sorts of design. I mean, I love modern, I love traditional, I love Spanish, I love, you know, I can appreciate all sorts of great designers. But personally, I like to design a space that has drama. I've spent a lot of time with my home, taking this beautiful period, 1926 English Tudor, and paid attention to all of its fine details and enhanced it as best as I could. You know, with great moldings and mosaic tiles and hand-painted murals, but still keeping it, you know, really, you know, with clean lines and vibrant, subtle colors. There's a way to take, you know, really great pieces and, you know, balance them out and figure out a way for everything to really have its own identity. you know, its own movement, you know, with great sensuous color. It's all about layering, you know, accessories into your space. And I spend a lot of time, you know, working with other people and also working on my own space, just making sure that I've taken advantage of my resources and I've made a point to really create something that is comfortable and easy in the eye.
Absolutely. The website is www.tatonthewall.com. Randy, thanks for dropping by.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Appreciate it, sir.
Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. There's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Just when you think it hasn't got bizarre enough in Aruba, MEP and Oduber call for a boycott of Diario. Freedom of speech apparently doesn't exist in Aruba. We all know about the Holloway investigation and all the negativity there. And one man who has stood up to the government and asked questions that a lot of people don't ask is Jossie Manser, and it's always nice to have Jossie on the program. Hi, Jossie.
Hi.
What's going on here? Boy, oh boy, it seems every time we turn around, all of a sudden they're trying to make you look like the bad guy now.
Oh, yeah, because we discovered a letter of bribery, a proposed bribery to the government of 1 million guilders, and we published the letter. The letter was very specific. It was signed by the Namgar Group's CEO, F.E. Namdar Group in New York. And after we published this letter and they found themselves in a lot of problems, they started to exercise what we consider here as a dictatorship attitude towards the paper. Now, he wrote all the department heads in his government, Nel Oduber, the prime minister, and asked them not to send any more advertisements to our paper. That's okay. We can live without that. But a boycott against the Diario with the people of Aruba is practically impossible. He can never carry it out.
The government's trying to play a card or draw a line in the sand, so to speak, with you, Jossie, and I guess shut you up, for lack of a better term. That's not going to happen, is it?
Of course not. No one can shut us up when we go for the truth. The truth is on our side, and what we do is expose corruption in Nel Oduber's government. There's a lot of corruption in there. And when we expose them, they get mad. They want to shut us up. I mean, that's the proper term. They want to shut us up. They don't want us to say anything. They don't want the people to know anything about their delinquent acts. So they come up with this kind of boycott or other kinds of terroristic practices that they have here in Aruba outside of the government.
Yeah, so much for freedom of speech or freedom of the press. I've obtained some questions from some listeners, Jossie, and I sent them off to you, and I thought what we'd do is bring you on and talk about them a little bit. But before I get to those, the Holloway story, of course, is one that's received international attention through the news media, and, of course, you've covered it and asked all the tough questions, but it's a lot more than just the Holloway case and the bribery, is it not?
Yeah, it goes much further, sure. But the Holloway case has a lot to do with this attitude that they have towards me and the Diario, no? Because Nello Dobell sent messages to all of us to keep quiet, not to give any interviews, not to say anything. Of course, we didn't pay any attention to him and the Diario, and he's not happy with that because he considers that the truth, the way we see it, has to be silenced in order for them to look good. And we're not about to do that. We will never do that.
Absolutely, and God bless you for that. I'm going to go through some of these questions with you now, Jossie. I know our time is limited. But one of the first ones is more of a comment rather than a question. It's how can we, the listeners or other people in the media, help you with this?
You know, one thing that can be done to put some sense into this man's head is to write to the Inter-American Press Association in Miami. We are a member of the Press Association. As a lot of letters went out through, from different groups to the Queen, Her Majesty, the Queen of Holland, and it's been published in practically all the papers in Holland and many other papers in Europe, and it's been picked up on the Internet by a few people. But this kind of attitude, this kind of dictatorship attitude, cannot be tolerated by us or by any other free medium in the world.
No, if the government starts to control the press, then we're going right back into, I think that guy's name was Adolf Hitler. Wasn't he the last one that tried to do that? Another question here, Jossie. It says the online edition has not been updated for a while. Will Diario continue with its online edition?
But of course, I mean, nothing has stopped us there. No. Our Diario on the Internet online will come out every day the way it has come out all the time since we're on the Internet. Sure. No stopping that.
Has there been any intimidation besides talk to you? Are you concerned for your safety or the safety of any of your staff?
You know, concerned per se, not in that sense, but you never know. You can find one of these drunk people or somebody that's been pumped with hatred from this man or this government. And you don't know when they can take some action against you, some physical action against you. So we're careful about that. I mean, we watch out for that.
You say that this has you know, been in the Netherlands in the papers and, of course, in Aruba. What sort of public comments have you been hearing?
Totally. I mean, 100% in favor of the Diario. I mean, you can silence us because we discovered that you were offered a bribe and you probably even got it. We're about to investigate that, too, and to find out who got the money and when and what they did with it. I mean, we're on top of it. That's why they're getting very scared and becoming very nervous. And the way to react on their side against this is to try to silence us. But that's not the way to do it. I mean, you have to go for the people who have the blame, not the people who discover it. But here with these people, I mean, like you very properly said in the beginning, in Aruba, anything can happen.
Well, yeah, it just seems like it's just beyond comprehension sometimes. Another question here, Jossie, says, what about Gabriel Bonifacio Margueta? I hope I pronounced that right. The 17-year-old boy who was missing per your article on February 22nd.
I remember the case. I mean, we always publish missing people for the families to help in their search and to locate them wherever they are. With this boy specifically, he ran away from home and he went to the second city of Aruba, which is St. Nicholas. He stayed with a few friends there, a family friend. They contacted his parents. The parents called him and the boy is back home safe now.
Okay, that's good to hear. Another question is about Gregory Kelly. Why was Gregory Kelly killed in Holland?
Well, you know, what we know about that case is that the Dutch authorities said that a fight broke up when they were drinking in some kind of bar, And one of the people involved pulled out the gun and shot him. I mean, we have absolutely no additional news with regards to that. And as far as we've been informed, that for the police in Holland, this case is closed in that sense, that it was just something that grew out of a brawl in a bar.
Another question we have here, Jossie, says, what happened in the case of Candelario Weaver? That's the guy who identified himself in Venezuela falsely as the assistant advisor to the Minister of Health in Aruba. He and two others were arrested with 3.5 kilos of cocaine.
Well, that's an interesting story. You know, this guy that identifies himself as Candelario Weaver has never come out and said that he is the Candelario Weaver that is involved. They caught him and two other people with 3.5 kilos of cocaine. And this Candelario Weaver, who identified himself as such as advisor to the Minister of Health, went, got $250,000, and purchased, he bought his freedom. But for that, the inspectors of the police, the two petejotas, the technical police of Venezuela, were arrested. They're still in jail for taking this bribe and letting this man go.
The ties between Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and what's going on with you right now or against you, what can you comment about that?
Well, you know, there is a lot of influence of Chavez with the people in this government. I mean, some of the ministers travel very frequently to Venezuela. They're seen with the governor of Falcón, that's a state close by here in Venezuela. We know that there is a strong tie between some of the ministers here and the parliament members of the MEP party with the government of Hugo Chavez. Where that is going to lead us, we don't know, but it's caught our attention and we're paying a close attention to it.
I want to talk a little bit about the Max DeVries case. Max DeVries was a 14-year-old who apparently drowned in Aruba in May 2004. What can you tell us about that, Jossie?
What we do know is very little, because when we contacted some of our sources in the police, the name Max DeVries doesn't appear anywhere in the computers. He's not in the police records now. I don't know what may have happened with that case. We don't know for certain what happened to this person. Some say that he drowned. He was in an accident on the ocean. But there is no record of him in the police files.
If you were to look up the term corruption in the dictionary, you would see a reference to the Natalie Holloway case. There's been so much corruption and cover-up and collusion. It's unbelievable, but it's a lot deeper than that. We haven't heard much about the Holloway case in the media lately. I try to cover it as much as I can on my program. Is there anything that you've heard that you can share with us, Jossie?
You know, we haven't heard anything, but let me share something with you. I have a man now in Holland, one of my main reporters, with a specific object of talking to these people who took all these documents with them to see if they will receive him.
Right.
And to find out with other people that we know in Holland what's going on with this, because it's been a few months now since they took this tons of documents and videos and tapes and whatever, and we haven't heard anything about it. I do have a man there, and we'll soon have some news, and I'll pass it on to you as soon as we get it.
Yeah, it's been very quiet. It's almost been eerily
yes.
quiet. Well, I guess if there's anything that we can sit back and rely on, Jossie, is that you have a strength and conviction with you and your staff to keep speaking the word. The government is trying to shut you up again, and that's not going to happen. And I certainly appreciate you coming on the program, and you're welcome here anytime, sir.
Thank you for the invitation. And we're in there, and we'll keep on punching in there until we have the answers that we're looking for. We're all looking for in the Holloway case. And also to keep a close eye on this government, because it's going totally in the wrong direction. I mean, under the influence of Chavez, dictatorial practices, where is this leading to?
Absolutely. Well, don't let the bastards get you down, Jossie. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Take care, sir.
Good night.
Yeah, bye-bye. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. She's a hot-footed baby. The ring that she couldn't hide. Porky Pig's right for this time of the year, but it's snowing where I'm at. This is Dana Pretzer. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. I'll take about 5 minutes and see if you want to call in and voice your opinion on any of the topics we covered tonight. 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. I want to thank all my guests and apologize to you for my funny-sounding voice and a couple of coughs that the cough button may not have picked up, but I've felt like crap for the last 2 weeks. I'm starting to come around a little bit, but again, I think it's a big conspiracy between the cold medicine makers and the pharmaceutical companies. I don't know. I want to thank all my guests this evening and remind you that this show is available for podcast a little bit later on this evening by going to www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio, and you can download the podcast from there and find out more information about the program. So I will take some calls if you are interested in calling in. I don't take calls that often, but now and then. 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. You know, when you try to take away the freedom of the press, like they're doing in Aruba with Jossie, you just go too far. And I know Jossie now for quite some time, and he has a lot that support him, and he has a lot of detractors. But one thing that you can say about Jossie is he won't give up. He'll keep speaking his mind, and that's a good thing. 1-306-842-7884. And I remind you to go to scaredmonkeys.com. That's the creme de la creme of the blogs on the internet. These types of blogs, this type of information is kicking butt, better than mainstream media any day. You want to find the truth about what's really going on, check out the blogs like Scared Monkeys on the internet. Okay, one last call for calls before I call it a night. My voice is pretty much shot anyway. 1-306-842-7884. I want to thank all my guests again for appearing on the program. And I remind you to go to scaredmonkeys.com/radio to listen to my daily commentary Monday to Friday. And then our weekly show is broadcast live from there too. And for those of you listening on Trust Cable, Channel 46 in Alabama, thank you. And for all of you listening to me on satellite, like you have for almost 10 years now, in October 2007, I appreciate that too. This is Dana Pretzer on Scared Monkeys Radio, signing off. Have a great night, and we'll see you soon.